At this time, I want to introduce Karen McCullough, the moderator for today's session. Karen, you have the microphone.
Thank you very much, Claudia. Good morning to those of you who are on the West Coast, in between, and good afternoon to those of you who have joined in the East. I'm Karen McCullough, the director of the National Organization of Nurses with Disabilities and organizational member of the National Disability Leadership Alliance Steering Committee. Let me first share some information about the NDLA. The National Disability Leadership Alliance is a coalition of 15 cross-disability organizations that are consumer-driven and led by people with disabilities. Today is historic for NDLA, as this is the first ever webinar we have initiated. We meet during monthly conference calls and to ensure ongoing communication via a listserv while addressing current and emerging issues and legislation confronting the disability community nationwide. And NDLA organizations, all of them, have their own missions, but we collectively join in collaboration to develop strategies that result in strong advocacy that addresses threats to our community. There are also threats to groups and organizations that are not specifically disability directed, and there is tremendous crossover of disability issues in the services and advocacy provided by organizations that are non-disability directed. Slide, please. NDLA Steering Committee members, and I'm going to save some time and sort of just do a summary. We have organizations that are addressing issues that are associated with people who are blind, who are deaf, who have significant hearing impairment, who have spinal cord and neurological conditions, and then others that are cross-disability oriented. Plus, we have a couple of specialty organizations like Not Dead Yet, addressing physician-assisted suicide, and we have my organization, the National Organization of Nurses with Disabilities. Next slide. So we have a second slide that gives the list continuing of the organizations, including four of us who are on this webinar that are steering committee members. Slide, please. The National Coalition of Mental Health is one that I did not mention, and I think that's a very important steering committee member for the input that they do offer. Building Capacity with New Allies. The title of this webinar is not a new idea, as we know that numerous committed minority groups and organizations have been addressing building capacity for many years. What precipitated the direction of this webinar was that since January, executive orders and legislation and the rhetoric of intolerance has promoted even greater racism and has introduced threats to communities across the country. That are disability directed and to organizations and minorities that are not. The threats run specifically deep within minority communities, including women, persons of color, members of the LGBTQI community, formerly incarcerated individuals, immigrants, refugees, members of religious groups, and the disabled. Slide, please. Today, we have 1 hour to address diversity and inclusion and to amplify the effect of protecting independence, safety, and self-determination. It is critical that we organize within the outside and inside the disability community so that campaigns are built by a diverse and inclusive collaboration of voices. The NDLA Steering Committee is committed to supporting and strengthening in any way we can intersectional efforts and believes that if marginalized communities that play such an important role in advocacy directed to their constituents join forces with more local, state, and national organizations together, we can be a greater force to be reckoned with in Washington, D.C. and around the country. There is no magic bullet. This takes time and collaboration, and where many groups have been working on building capacity for several years. Today we have two presenters that have models represented by two organizations that are members of the NDLA steering committee, where both models are inclusive. One providing a model of activism and the other taking the initiative in rural America. Our guest speaker will be addressing race and exclusion, and I think it's very important. It's one minority area that we are bringing today to the forum of this webinar, but it's not the only issue that needs to be addressed. The bios of our presenters are available on the registration page. It is now my pleasure to introduce to you Bruce Starling, an organizer and a main leader within the ADAPT community. Bruce, take it from here.
Karen, thank you so much. And I want to just publicly thank you for fearlessly working to move NDLA to the next level. It was not an easy task to get us to do this webinar and to take action, but I really appreciate you doing that. And I wanted to thank Melissa for joining us. We didn't know what we were doing when we started this process, and she's been incredibly gracious through the process that we've been going through. So I'm going to start with ADAPT. ADAPT is a national grassroots community that organizes disability rights activists to engage in nonviolent direct action, including civil disobedience, to assure the civil and human rights of people with disabilities to live in freedom. So ADAPT is not your typical top-down organization. We're not your typical organization in general. We are a collective, a grassroots community. And there are two primary things that we are focused on. It is organizing or community organizing, building groups of folks at the local level, and the activism that we do, which is nonviolent, but it is direct action, which does include protest and civil disobedience. Move to the next slide, please. So for us, community organizing and activism creates opportunities for people with disabilities to advocate for ourselves. ADAPT is organized through chapters who do direct action and advocate on local issues. Now, as I said, direct action does include civil disobedience, which people are familiar with, but it includes a whole variety of other things, including public accountability sessions, street theater, anything where groups of people get together and confront power directly. So some of the local issues that folks have dealt with is, one of my favorite is out of El Paso, their campaign one summer to make the every Dairy Queen in El Paso accessible. So they relentlessly worked moving from Dairy Queen to Dairy Queen to make sure that they were all accessible, protest after protest. In Rochester, New York, we had a group of folks who fought to oppose the fare increase for paratransit. There was a massive increase to paratransit fares that was proposed. And folks use street theater, public protest, and even singing the 12 days of paratransit during the holiday season to get the message across that these fares were going to be far too much. And it's not on the slide, but we've even had a chapter do a protest at an adult bookstore to make that accessible because, of course, access should be everywhere for people with disabilities. Our chapters are bound together, however, on a focus on our national issue, which is the community integration of people with disabilities and the fight for our lives and liberty. So we oppose any force that institutionalizes us, no matter where it comes from. The institutional bias runs deep. It starts with ableism and the assumptions that we can't actually do what we need to do for ourselves, but it's embedded in policies and procedures that force folks with disabilities into institutions. And whether it's the opposition to the owners of the nursing facilities and other institutions or organized labor that would prefer to have us all clustered together where they can organize the workers, we're fighting every day to free our people. Next slide, please. So the foundation of ADAPT is trust and connection. So unlike other organizations that have membership cards and dues, we are all about trust and connection. So the first thing is our focus on our collective purpose and cause. The thing that you notice when you come to an Adapt Action is that we are laser focused on dealing with the issues that we need to address. Some folks describe it as kind of a military approach, but it's not quite that because we value and respect everyone who joins the cause. If it is a military, it is an all-volunteer military. The focus on our cause binds us together, and we respect and appreciate everyone who joins in action. And I think one of the exciting things for me as a person in the movement who's helping lead some of these actions was an action a number of years ago where Claire came to us from Arizona. She came with some folks. She was a trans woman, and we were at the end of the line walking along, and she just pulled me aside and she said, "I've never just entered into a group where I was immediately accepted for who I am." And I felt happy and sad at the same time. Sad that that was the world we live in, but happy that she found that with ADAPT. We are not perfect, however, and one of the things that we work very hard is to figure out how to enforce that by the collective and how we can address issues that are emerging for us. So one of the things that we're working on now is to try to figure out how we can better address the issues faced by Muslims in America without getting sort of bogged down and sort of laser focusing that language so that we can be affirming of them and people can actually understand that. So that's an area we're working on. Clearly, we have not got that down. I think the intensity of our work pulls us together as well. So think about trust exercises. You fall into the arms of someone and it's supposed to build trust. Now do that with surrounded by security guards and Capitol Police. You have an intense trust experience. But that's what we put our bodies in lines, our bodies on the line and trust each other to support each other. And there is a recognition that all of us together achieve our goals. We celebrate our victories, and at our big meetings when we're talking about the day, everyone is encouraged to share the work that they have accomplished and to recognize for their contribution. Next slide, please. So leadership comes from the collective. Our publicly identified, quote, leaders are organizers who advance the collective, and our representatives from the individual chapters make up the decision-making body of ADAPT. And I'm actually in Denver right now where that collective is going to come together and talk about making decisions for moving forward. We have multiple levels of leadership in our actions. It's ever-changing, so there is not a set group of people who lead what we do. It's always rotating and moving around. We are deliberate in making sure our leadership is representative in these actions. So we have a strong, thoughtful protocol about who is actually going to lead, making sure that we're representative of the community, not just of the individuals who are at the action, but of the broader community as well. For me, I think I came on following an action in California where ADAPT was criticized for not having people who were non-visibly disabled. So it was kind of interesting for me to come in at that point. What was neat was a good friend of mine who was a trans man who was in leadership already mentored me. So this was like, you know, in the early 90s when I was actually being brought into leadership within ADAPT. And that was a very positive experience in terms of, for me, having someone mentor me, but that's part of what we do as well. We work to mentor leaders in our movement within ADAPT. Between the actions, the national work is done in work groups and chapters, so that's sort of how the work happens in between. You hear a lot about what we do, but that's the big push. Next slide. So the changing what we do is through our actions, we're fighting structural ableism and internalized ableism. So one of the things that people don't recognize is that people with long-term services and supports disabilities generally have been disenfranchised in our movement and society. So one of the things that's difficult about organizing is that these issues are not necessarily in the forefront of most people with disabilities' minds, well, at least until the Republicans decide to pull services out from underneath all of us. And then we have sort of the internalized ableism that we're dealing with, because a lot of us has sort of sucked up the ableism that says that some disabled people can't live in the community or they need to be placed in nursing facilities to be safe, or that some people are less than. And for us, one of the things that's difficult is if you acknowledge that the folks who are locked up in institutions had no, there was no reason for that. It makes the world unsafe for all of us. So it's a real, sometimes a difficult jump for people to make. That said, the change that happens when we do actions doesn't just, isn't just between ADAPT and its target. It changes how activists see themselves. I've watched as people in fighting this fight have seen themselves differently and have seen themselves as more, much more powerful, and it changes how others see us. Clearly, the recent actions have demonstrated that we are more than what people assumed we could be. Next slide, please. Developing allies. So our actions get us to the table, and our, what we're looking for is respect for those where we can get together. So for example, years ago, we took over the Senate Finance Committee hearing room. Although we had a very tough action to get there, it was the work we did after that solidified our allyship with folks who were on the inside. NDLA has also proven to be a great place for a collective voice of people with disabilities, and it's very exciting. We're still finding our way and determining where we move forward, particularly thanks to Karen now. But this is really a unique aspect of our community because this is a voice run of the organizations run by people with disabilities, and frankly, we're doing it with no money. The diversity of ADAPT members opens door, and leadership opens other doors. So it's not just, I want to point out that it's not just securing or getting allies, it's about being allies. So our on-the-street experience with police in ADAPT, so we probably have more experience on the street with police than most disability organizations, it means we really need to know what the hell's going on when you're dealing with police, just for our own safety. We're thinking about issues of people of color, immigrants, LGBTQ folks. There are clear trans folks. There are clear safety issues that are at play. But we turn that into allyship by, I'm thinking through our experience in Little Rock. The opening of our action in Little Rock, we took the opportunity to express support for the protests that were happening in Ferguson because we were in proximity and the timing and the framing of that really fit with what we were doing. Additionally, when we were just in Columbus, a lot of folks saw some really difficult pictures of folks being pushed out of their wheelchairs and all sorts of drama there. That opened up conversations on the ground in Columbus with Black Lives Matter folks, and we talked about how we could work together, how they could leverage the stories that were coming out of our protest to basically address what is a longstanding issue with the Columbus police in terms of Black Lives Matter and their attacks on people of color. So moving to the next slide with mobilization. We're really working to leverage the recent actions, the protests around the Medicaid cuts, to transform the disability community. There has been a myth that we can't mobilize people. I think that myth has been busted. The assumption, what is wrong, however, is, or has been difficult, is that the messaging wasn't right. We have now had more than 30 actions in more than 30 cities and sustained activity for multiple weeks fighting this Republican bill. But that is just the fight against something. What we need is the fight for something. And I think we're trying to help Democrats understand that the framing of our fight as life and, as fighting for life and liberty isn't about just opposing this bill. It's actually about something that resonates far more deeply. So as we're moving forward, we need to have messaging that resonates with our grassroots, that's intersectional both in message and messenger. So we're working very hard to make sure that our messengers are intersectional. That we need to highlight the power we have and include specific asks and be hopeful. We're pushing Democrats and progressives to embrace our issue, speak to it, fight for us, and give us the tools we need to fight for them and to pull out the vote. Now that's the political sort of focus of this. We are in a struggle to achieve social justice. So on the next slide, please.
1 minute.
So, thank you. I'm finishing up. The just world we strive for will only be achieved through solidarity with marginalized communities, so multiply marginalized people with disabilities will be the leaders in our communities who make that happen. So as a community, we need to listen to them, learn from them, and we need to act accordingly. We need to understand that there is a toll that comes with being multiply marginalized, and there is nothing that stings, and I can speak from personal experience, there is nothing that stings more than being marginalized by people you are a part of. So I call upon us all to look to people who are multiply marginalized and help advance them as leaders within our movement. Karen, I'll turn it over to you now.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bruce. Anyone who's on this webinar that hasn't heard of adapters in all these cities with their protests have missed a lot of heartwarming, but also struggling with issues that are going to impact us, particularly on Medicaid cuts and cats. It is my pleasure now to introduce to you our guest speaker, Vylissa Thompson. She's calling in from South Carolina. She is the founder and CEO of Ramp Your Voice. I hope you had a chance to read her bio. We're very pleased to have her on. She will be talking about intersectional efforts, because there may be some people on the webinar that don't understand that, and specifically focusing on race. So, Vylissa, thank you very much, and take it from here.
Thank you so much, Karen. I'm so glad to be here to be able to talk to you all today about what I specifically focus on in my advocacy work. Slide, please. When I started Ramp Your Voice almost 4 years ago, the midst Wednesday, I saw this very big gap in our community when it comes to the way that we address race and the inclusion of disabled people of color. And when I became a part of this work, I realized that we also have a big gap in our ability to build bridges, not only with members within our community, but outside communities as well. We harp on the concept that other marginalized communities should back our work issues to be better allies, understand what the disabled experience is all about. But we cannot expect those things if we steadily are able to reciprocate these efforts within our community and outside of that. I know we have a very big problem with showing solidarity when it comes to issues that multiple marginalized people endure in this community, particularly race, LGBTQ issues, et cetera. And I really wish that we would do a better job at bridging those gaps, because we cannot see bridging gaps of solidarity as a one-way street. It must exist in an act by all parties involved, and we have to step up and see a better role in that. Slide, please. One of the issues that I've seen is our particularly narrow focus on disability only. It is well known within our circles the hesitation and or resistance to discussing identities and oppression outside of disability. This narrow tunnel vision view, so to speak, harms those of us who are equally oppressed based on our disability as we are the other identities that we may have. I like to say for myself in particular that you cannot separate my disability from my blackness and my blackness from my cisgender or woman identity and not see the whole me. So really when we have that narrow view of disability and we ignore the other identity that somebody has, we are not having a completely whole picture of that person and the oppressions that they endure. This view is exclusionary, and it creates a hostile environment for disabled people with marginalized identities to discuss their particular experiences and not feel safe to do so. I know that in certain circles, that resistance has really silenced a great bit of people and really have them see that they are not safe to really discuss the issues that matter to them. And that right there is a invisibility issue that we all need to be aware of. Next slide. There are several reasons for the tunnel vision view that I've mentioned, but I want to discuss three that I commonly see in my work and have experienced personally: microaggressions of whiteness, and a lack of understanding privileges. Minority members of our community experience microaggressions. And for those of you who may not know, a microaggression is a statement, action, or incident regarded as an instance of indirect, subtle, or unintentional discrimination against members of a marginalized group, such as a racial or ethnic minority. I've seen this recently happen to me online. I asked the question that pertains to Black disabled women or Finnies about the experience that we have. And I find it very peculiar that white disabled people jump into that conversation. And that action of jumping into a conversation that was not directed towards you is a microaggression, because it makes you the center of a discussion when you are not the target audience for the discussion. And it's those little things like that that may seem very minute to the person committing that microaggression, but to the person on the receiving end. It is yet another example as to why they are silenced, why they are ignored, why they're still invisible, why their voices aren't heard. So it's a very big issue that we need to really pay attention to and how we engage with each other when we see conversations going. Do we, you know, is it best for me to just be a bystander and look at the conversation, maybe learn from what's being said, and not intercede my opinions when it's not being sought after? Really thinking more critically as to how we engage with each other so that we do not unintentionally offend someone because we may be a little ignorant to the conversation at hand or a little ignorant to how to properly engage with members of our community. Next slide. The over-whiteness in our community is seen everywhere, particularly in our disability or advocacy spaces where white civil voices are prominent in discussing topics of interest and fighting against inequalities, and within leadership roles of prominence and grassroots disability-centered organizations. This over-whiteness is the reason why certain lived experiences receive pushback, particularly from that of disabled people of color. And that kind of goes back to that tunnel vision, that narrow focus that I mentioned, as to why the resistance, when we talk about racially based issues in the community, it receives that pushback because we have leadership that have these privileges and have this minority lived experience who may not understand why such discussions need to occur. Next slide. And those privileges that I mentioned is something that I really harp on in the work that I do. And I really feel that disabled white people do not understand that their disability does not nullify their white privilege. I'm going to say that again. Their disability does not nullify their white privilege. And I think that's a very key concept that many white disabled people have trouble understanding. Because many of them have this idea that I'm disabled, I don't have privilege. No, we all have privileges. We all experience oppression. But as disabled people, we do not experience oppression the same way. And this quote by Peggy McIntosh is one of my favorite quotes to use when I discuss what privilege is to social workers, disabled communities, etc. And it says, privilege exists when one group has something of value that is denied to others simply because of the group they belong to, rather than because of anything they've done or failed to do. Access to privilege doesn't mean one's outcome, but it's definitely an asset that makes it more likely that whatever talent, ability, and aspirations a person with privilege has will result in something positive for them. Next slide. Basically, we define privilege as a set of unearned benefits given to people who fit a specific social group. Society grants privilege to people because of certain aspects of the identity. Aspects of a person's identity can include race, class, gender, sexual orientation, language, geographical location, ability, and religion. It is definitely easier to understand the oppression you personally experience than the privileges you experience. Just being mistreated is likely to leave a bigger impression on you than being treated fairly. Privilege is basically the opposite of oppression. Privileged groups have power over oppressed groups. So basically, what I encounter resistance from disabled white people about their white privilege is the failure to understand that the privileges you experience is just as important as the oppressions that you experience, and understand how this privilege or white privilege may not have been something you asked for, but it's something that you benefit from since day one. Two disabled people can have the same disability down to the T, can have the same lived experiences down to the T, but if one is white and one is not, the way that this world interacts with them is completely different. And that is a fact and not an opinion. Next slide. And one of the things that our community has a big issue with is intersectionality. Intersectionality is important because it forces us to see all of the dynamics that play in a person's world, both visible and invisible, understood or overlooked. You cannot focus on one aspect of a person's being and proclaim to see the whole person when multiple oppressions and marginalizations are in place. Seeing the whole person is essential to understanding their full human experience. And this is why many of us, particularly those of us of color, who are advocates, push for intersectionality because of the overwhiteness and the microaggressions and the privileges that has shaped the history of this community, the voices who are deemed as prominent leaders versus those who are not. I know in my particular work, I focus on the unsung, unrecognized heroes in this movement that do not get the recognition that they deserve because they are of color and disabled. And this term, as you will see on the slide, is coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, a black woman who really has created this term that really hones in on how we need to do better in understanding that we may have one particular common trait, but it does not mean that we all experience the world the same way. Next slide.
2 minutes.
Thank you. So what can be done? So here are a couple of ideas of what I believe can be done today to really get our community where it should be when it comes to intersectionality and building those bridges within the community, because I believe that this work starts at home, quote unquote, and then outside of the community and connecting with other marginalized groups. First is being understand that though we may be in a struggle together, we do not struggle the same way. Again, it goes back to what I had said earlier about us not experiencing the world similarly. We need to support the work of multiple marginalized disabled people. That's very important because there are disabled advocates of color who are within several intersectional identities who are doing incredible work that do not get the recognition that it deserves in this community. And it's time to recognize their work, hire them for the services that they offer, and to really give them the space to really do the work that's needed. Take ownership of the overwhiteness issues within your organization's advocacy work. Really look around and assess, have I created a culture that is white dominated? If so, how do I correct that? What can I do to get more intersectional voices and faces in this organization, in the work that we're doing? Next slide. Make it a priority to strengthen your solidarity muscles, because our community is unique in the fact that anyone can become a member of it throughout the lifespan. And I think it's very important for us to remember anyone can become disabled, which means that our community should always make it a priority to be intersectional and welcoming and safe environment for people to be a part of. It is time to do the work that is needed to become the allies we wish to have. We cannot wait for tomorrow. It starts today. And I want our community to do a very serious self-inventory as to how we can be held more accountable and strategize how to be in true solidarity and build up bridges for other groups. And on my last slide of the presentation, I have listed several advocates, next slide please, that has really been doing the intersectional work of the community, such as T.L. Lewis, Linnea Brown, Leroy Moore, Anita Cameron, Tia Brown, Alice Wong. All of these persons are people of color, and all of them are doing the work that is long overdue, and I am very happy to call everybody on this list friends and colleagues, and I really want to see organizations really give them the space to really do the work that is needed, to support them, to hire them, and to really make the disabled community better than what it is right now. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Vanessa, very much. I think that will be helpful for people to understand more about intersectionality. It is my pleasure now to introduce Billy Alton, who is the Executive Director of the Association for Programs of Rural Independent Living, and I'm very glad to have the rural point of view on this webinar. And also, Billy is calling in from Arkansas. So, Billy, will you take it from here?
Absolutely. Thank you, Karen. What a pleasure it is to be on this webinar with all of you today and presenting with Bruce and Melissa. I hope I can live up to the performances that they just gave. But what I want to talk about today is casting a wider net, taking inventory of your community and making the first move. So next slide. What I'd like to do first is tell you who April is. April, the Association of Programs for Rural Independent Living, is a national membership organization dedicated to advancing the rights and responsibilities of people with disabilities in rural America, which is a whole new challenge when you get out into the wide open spaces of America. Next slide, please. But as a membership organization, providing training and technical assistance to our rural members is a critical component of the services we offer. One of the things that we're probably most known for is our peer-to-peer programs. Independent Living really got its foundation from peer support of a person with a disability mentoring with another person with a disability. So we took that and moved it to the next level and looked at, put an organization, mentor another organization if they're struggling. And that took off, and we've been doing it now for just over 15 years with this program. And over the last few years, we've decided that we needed to even branch it out a little more and look at if a statewide independent living council could mentor another statewide independent living council. So that program has taken off, and we're doing good. We also have a rich history in transportation advocacy. We've done a lot of stuff through the years, try to always be at the table when policy is being written that would impact people with disabilities. But equally important to us is ensuring that young people with disabilities are involved in all facets of our program development and delivery. We try to be truly committed to the mantra, nothing about us without us. Having said that, we incorporated two new youth spots on our board of directors and have an incredibly active youth committee, which is incredibly diverse. They probably do a much better job of being diverse than a lot of other programs that we have. And also at our conference each year, we have a youth conference that has been attended by generally around 80 young people over the past 6 or 7 years, growing a really strong group of youth to take over in leadership roles. And in that regard, my training and technical assistance director, Mary Olson, got her feet wet as a youth at the Center for Independent Living, then became part of our youth group at April. And went from there, I saw how wonderful she was and gave her an opportunity to be a National Training and Technical Assistance Director. So I always want to try to put my money where my mouth is. If I'm going to talk about young people, I want to have them in positions that they can make decisions that impact themselves and their brothers and sisters. Next slide, please. But what I want to do today is I'm going to look at stuff more through a transportation lens, so that I'm not incredibly repetitive with what my colleagues have been talking about, but there are going to be some similarities in what we're talking about. So, of course, the title of my piece was Casting a Wider Net, Taking Inventory. So why would you take inventory? And this can also be applicable to any other programs, your housing programs, your youth programs. But mainly, the reason to do inventory is because each community is different. You're going to have different services, different organizations, different types of programs that are there. So what you try to do is identify some like minds and build some friendships. And I'm looking at this really through the rural lens again, because when you're identifying those folks, collaboration sometimes is a lot more than money. You have to build, as Bruce mentioned, and also I heard Melissa say this too, is respect. You have to build that respect among your community. And sometimes your word and your reputation is all they have to go on, especially in rural America, and I think it's true across the country, but certainly so in some of the smaller areas. When we don't have a lot of money, your word is gold. Next slide, please. So some examples when you're thinking about transportation, and again, collaboration, one of my favorite things to tell folks is collaboration is not just a good idea. It's a law. Thankfully, in the FAST Act for transportation, our surface transportation bill, requires folks, especially our human service providers, to collaborate. So whenever I'm looking at folks, I tell them, you know, look around at some of your general folks are going to be your area agencies on aging. You know, they generally are always providing some type of transportation services. Churches in rural America. A lot of churches have either a van or some type of transportation that they have at their disposal that generally sets through the week. We need to figure out ways to collaborate and coordinate with those folks. A lot of times United Ways may have either some vehicles or some money. And of course, the obvious is cab companies. We forget a lot of times about incorporating cab companies into our business. On a national level, too, at schools, one of my favorites is, it's not on the slide, but schools. We need to be working with our schools a lot closer. We do this, certainly do this with our youth programs, is getting into those schools and identifying those young men and women who have a disability and turning them on to the independent living philosophy. On a national level, we also have looked at it from with April as joining other groups like the Equity Caucus, America Walks, and Rails to Trails. I know folks always ask me that it's interesting that you'd be working with America Walks and some of these other groups, but they're advocating for transportation, and a lot of times they're advocating for the built environment. So I like to be involved with those guys and get them to realize that people with disabilities enjoy Mother Nature as well. We like to get out and walk and do the trails. So be mindful that as they're being advocates, to include all of us. And also we've worked a lot with the Center for Rural Strategies, who works on a lot of different issues, but had never really thought of disability issues. So always trying to get my foot in the door with groups that traditionally don't work with people with disabilities, and getting involved with them so that they are aware of who we are, what we do, what we're trying to get accomplished, and create some new allies. Because a lot of times it's not what you know, but it's who you know, and in order to get things accomplished. Next slide, please. So one of the things that I always strive to do is meet people where they are. And by that, I mean a lot of times they're not going to come to you. You have to inventory your communities and your nation, who all these folks are that are the players. Identify who they are and go to them. Meet them where they are. And finally, my contact information is on this last slide. And at the bottom, there's the old slogan, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. This is said in D.C. a lot. One of the things that we try to add to that is, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Well, we want to set the table. And that way we can have a little bit more control on the topics that are discussed and the input that is provided. And I think I blew through that in a hurry. But I wanted to say thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to present with such a great group of fellow presenters and caring. I will turn it back over to you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Billy. I'm glad that you're addressing transportation, because we know that transportation is such a challenge in rural America. And I can relate to that, because I come from a small town that I can't even get to. And if I did get there, there's no taxis, there's no buses, anything. So this is a huge issue, particularly for paratransit and jurisdictional issues. So I'm going to turn this over immediately then to Gary Arnold, who is also representing Little People of America, which is one of the NDLA steering committee members, to address some questions, and he will probably identify one of our presenters to be able to address it. Gary, questions?
Hello. Thank you, Karen, and thank you to all of the presenters today. Just a reminder, in the chat section, of the webinar, you're able to submit questions, and I will try to get to everything. We have got a little more than 10 minutes for questions. I want to start off, though, with a question that I'll open up to all three presenters. Anyone feel free to chime in if you've got input. But what would you identify in your experience as one of a significant obstacle to building partnerships with groups that traditionally don't partner with disability groups? And how do you address that obstacle?
I can start. This is Alyssa, and with my particular work, I focus on social workers and the Black community. And with social workers, the social work typically engages with disabled people through provided services and support. My focus with social workers is to reshape how we understand disability. In our programs, we still teach person's first language. I focus on teaching them why identity first language is preferred in the community. I have to understand disability from intersectional lens, talking about the experiences of disabled Black people and other people of color. I focus on the issues of disabled women or families who seek sexual or reproductive services and how to make their clinics and facilities more accessible in both the content and language used, also the services, and reducing the ableism that exists. When it comes to the Black community, I focus on the way that we look at disability and some of the negative connotations in identifying with just being disabled and being able to say the words and really open up the discussion for the people who are Black and disabled to really share their experiences and to really talk about the stigma and the ableism that exists. And also allow people to understand that it's okay to be disabled and to be disabled and to be socially and politically disabled. So for me, the educational piece is one way that I have shaped my work to really bridge those gaps and to really connect with communities that either are not very knowledgeable about our experience and or are knowledgeable to an extent and to really upgrade what they know so that it is more accommodating and accepting and current, because a lot of languages and ideas are very outdated. So that's kind of what I do in my particular work, in kind of bridging those gaps with communities that don't really focus on disability and let them know that disability affects everybody, whether directly or indirectly, and how to be aware of the ableism that you may harbor and help to unlearn those ideals about disability.
This is Bruce. I'd like to jump in. So in terms of the connection with the LGBTQ community, living in both communities, one of the things that strikes me is we have incredibly similar structures. So my acculturation to the disability community was very easy because actually everything looked very familiar to me in terms of how we, families of choice, that type of thing, just sort of those internal structures. But it's the overriding values that we have, some of those that are very, very different. And I think it does go back to ableism very much within the LGBTQ community. So if there's a lot of focus on physical ability, physical beauty, and disability is seen as, you know, not unless you're within a certain group of folks, you're just, you struggle within the LGBTQ community. And we have just worked very hard to get basic access to events. When we've gotten access, things have really turned out well. I know that we fought to get access to, oddly enough, an event locally called Stronger Together, which was going to be in an inaccessible location. When we got there, everyone was very tense because, of course, there's a lot of folks with disabilities, a lot of queer folks. And as we were introducing ourselves, it took a guy from our group, because folks were saying, "Hi, I'm John, I'm gay. Hi, I'm Sarah, I'm bisexual." And they got to him and he said, you know, everyone saw the first person with a disability just spoke, and he said, "My name is Joe, I'm a trisexual because I'll try anything twice." That humor broke through and connected us in a very real way. So that was a real positive thing in sort of building those connections. So although it might be difficult to get into the room sometimes, I think it's the human connection that you make afterward. And then ultimately, I think some of the issues we have is because there are a lot of people in the LGBTQ community who are service providers, who are social workers and such, they bring that kind of client approach to working with us, and we struggle against that. But those are some of the it does come down to ableism.
Exactly. Hi, Billy. I'd like to build just quickly on what Bruce said, too. As a person with a physical disability, a chair user, built environment sometimes is one of our big obstacles. And I've been invited to speak places, and you can't get on the stage. And that really changes the optics of what that group was trying to accomplish when they realized that the person they invited to speak, they can't even get them up on the stage. And a lot of times, you're not going to pick me up onto anything because I'm just not going to let you do that. So it kind of sometimes an embarrassing moment for them can really open people's eyes when they've been embarrassed, especially if there happens to be media in the room too. Nothing like a little public shaming. So go ahead, Gary.
Hi, Gary. This is Karen. May I add something?
Sure, but we do have questions coming in, so I want to be sure to get that. So if you could do it quick.
Hey, no, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I just want to be, you know, this in a way kind of follows up on it and addresses some of the stuff that people have brought up. But a question is that it seems that sometimes it's hard to build alliances with senior citizen advocacy organizations because seniors sometimes don't want to identify as people with disabilities, even when they may share some of the same needs. But might reject alliance with disability groups. Any insights on how to address this issue? And again, I think this is open for all the participants.
This is Bruce. Actually, my husband did a research project, a participant action research project of elderly individuals in nursing facilities. And what struck me was they had a real sophisticated disability consciousness. I think some of the difficulty we have is we're talking to older individuals who are on the approach to disability, and we're not actually talking to folks on the other side of that. And a lot of things that are happening is this sort of ageist issue within the that community where it's younger, older folks who are speaking for people as opposed to allowing them to speak for themselves because of ageism. So I think cutting through some of that ageism piece where we can actually talk to folks who have the lived experience and creating opportunities for those conversations are going to be really important for us. But I was surprised at the level of sophistication in their consciousness. It really amazed me.
Karen, let's go back to you. I apologize before about cutting you off.
No, that's okay, because I was going to address a total different topic on the first question that came in. I'm a healthcare professional, and I worked in community health for 7 years in the city of Chicago. And when we're talking about partnering or creating alliances with organizations that are not disability specific, I wanted to just comment that when I visited so many of my patients in their homes or apartments, I would walk in and probably go to the refrigerator to see if they had their medication or whatever, and I noted that there were half-eaten food in containers. And I will tell you that creating awareness that there is such a direct connection with the disability community for Meals on Wheels, and I'm just identifying this one connection, because if it was not for Meals on Wheels, many of our seniors, people with chronic health conditions and disabilities in their homes would not have any food. And so creating an alliance like that and creating the awareness of how closely we are connected is another way that we can address creating those alliances. That was all I wanted to say. Thanks, Gary.
Hear, hear.
And Gary, if I could just add one other thing. I think the LGBTQ community in dealing with HIV, we came to a realization that you didn't need to self-identify as gay to get the services and supports, and I think doing the same for seniors, letting them come to an acceptance of disability, but still being open to them and talking their language is really important as well.
Thank you, Bruce. I think we've got time for one more question before we'll close it up. But Lisa, I want to go back to you with a question. In talking about privilege, and have you recognized any of your own privilege within yourself, and how has that impacted the way you understand intersectionality? We'll give it to you, Lisa, too, and then if others want to add, feel free. But Lisa, you first.
Oh, yes. I am very aware of my privileges. I have education privilege, light skin privilege as a black woman, cisgender privilege, heterosexual privilege, and neurotypical privilege. So in understanding privilege, it's not anything I'm ashamed of. These are not instances that I had asked for, except for the educational privilege that I have. The rest are those that I was born with. But in understanding my privileges, I understand how each of those separately and when combined together has afforded me certain opportunities that others may not have had. And because I may present in a certain way due to my physical makeup, my ability to interact with the world, I know that there are certain opportunities afforded to me than others. So with having that very firm grasp of what my privileges has allowed me to experience, the benefits of experience than other people who may have similar traits as myself, it makes me see that intersectionality has greatly shaped how the world interacts with me and how I interact with the world, and also see how the world can counter interact with those who do not have those same privileges or who may have similar privileges in myself, but because they may not have certain traits or certain characteristics, that their experience is quite different. So for me, being very aware of my privileges, not being ashamed of those, and also understanding that there are certain things that are, quote-unquote, as some of those younger folks say, outside of my lane, and understanding in my range, so I won't oversell and try to talk over people or talk for people who don't have certain privileges. That is something I always keep in the back of my mind. Who would be better than for me to talk about certain issues? Like today, during this webinar, I published a post about an app character who is autistic and black, and I did not write that piece. It was a cross post for somebody who is black and autistic. So giving people opportunity to tell their stories who are either neurodivergent, who have other identities with blackness that I don't have, giving them the space to tell their stories or to tell their perspectives about why a particular character or situation affects them greatly, is giving that space and not overstepping and not over-talking. So that's how I look at my privileges and understand sexuality from a personal standpoint and what I project out in the work that I do.
All right, great. Thank you, Violeta. I'm going to hold it there. I've got one more question. We're at the point where I'm supposed to turn it back over to Karen, but Bruce, if I can just address this to you, and if you can maybe take 30 seconds to try to answer. The question is about what about uniting with people in the deaf community? There's a lot of resistance, I have noticed, with not wanting to be a part of other organizations that might be thought of as, quote, hearing only. So what does ADAPT do to try to create an inclusive environment for people deaf and hard of hearing and do outreach to that community?
Actually, we have a strong deaf contingent within ADAPT, particularly because we're from Rochester, so we have the largest per capita number of deaf folks, so we always have sign language interpreters at the actions and for the meetings, so we do provide the access and encourage folks, and within the actions, there's this amazing process that happens where we're translating what we're doing in English into ASL, so there's a number of things that we're doing, so if there are folks who are interested in that, we've had a deaf individual lead our communications team. So there's a lot that we're doing there. If folks are interested, they should just reach out to us by email.
Great. Thank you so much, Bruce, and thank you, everyone, for participating and for joining the call. I'm going to turn it back over to Karen.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Gary. Great job. I want to thank everyone who has joined this webinar today. I wanted to just pick up on a few things. The NDLA steering committee, just in the process of setting up and getting ready to conduct this webinar, have had many lessons learned. And it was interesting when the announcement went out about this webinar. There were people on the NDLA generalist sort of that began to comment. I looked at all those comments and felt that it was very positive feedback. And we recognize that this webinar has not brought people to the table to present that represent all the marginalized groups that we've talked about religious groups, immigrants, formerly incarcerated individuals, and so forth. But this is a start for us. We're learning. We also have set up a task force on racism within the disability community that it's in its infancy. And so we want to make sure that we have the right people at the table, but it's a start. So the resource, there is a resource list that's available, and it was downloadable on the registration page. But once the session is over, we will not have, it will go away. And so there will be, the resource list will be put onto the www.ndla.org website, along with the recording and a transcript once available. Thank you to Bruce Darling from ADAPT, to Billy, Alton from April, and especially to Nylissa Thompson. Really appreciated your input. Very, very valuable. And to Gary for fielding our questions. And at this point, we have done a lot in 1 hour. We know we have lots more work to do. And I thank you very, very much for joining the webinar. At this point, I will adjourn. Thank you and have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Karen.